3. Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today in the studio, it's the anniversary since the Rolling Stones began their unprecedented bid as the world's greatest rock and roll band by serving up a beggar's banquet.
It was a very, very strange time. We were having problems with money with Alan Klein. All kinds of things were going on. Anita had switched from Brian to Keith as a girlfriend, which messed Brian up. It was a very confusing period of time. Hi, this is Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones in the studio serving a beggar's banquet.
The Rolling Stones forsook psychedelic experimentation to return to their blues roots on this celebrated album, which was immediately acclaimed as one of their landmark achievements, writes Richie Unterberger on AllMusic.com. Street Fighting Man, a reflection of the political turbulence of 1968, was one of their most innovative singles, and Sympathy for the Devil, with its fire-dancing guitar licks, leering Mick Jagger vocals, African rhythms, and explicitly satanic lyrics, was an image-defining epic. On Stray Cat Blues, Jagger and crew began to explore the kind of decadent sexual sleaze that they would take to the point of self-parody by the mid-70s, Unterberger concludes. At the time, though, the approach was still fresh and the lyrical bite of most of the material ensured Beggar's Banquet's place as one of the top blues-based rock records of all time, end quote. It's that kind of praise that prompted Rolling Stone magazine writers to rank Beggar's Banquet at number 57 on their top 500 albums of all time list. It was the last full album to feature band original lead guitarist Brian Jones, joined by lead singer Mick Jagger, rhythm guitarist Keith Richards, drummer Charlie Watts, and bass player Bill Wyman in March 1968 in London's Olympic Studios. According to Bill Wyman, one of the first songs the Rolling Stones recorded then didn't end up on Beggar's Banquet album at all.
We were in a rehearsal studio just outside London, and Mick and Keith were late, surprised me, and myself, Brian and Charlie were sitting around just messing, and I was on an electric keyboard, and I started to play this riff. Da, 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 and Brian was kind of playing some sort of guitar rhythm to it, and Charlie was playing a drum beat. And we were messing with it for about 5 or 10 minutes, and Mick and Keith walked in while it was going on. And they said, "Well, don't forget that, that's really good. Remember that, don't you forget it." And so we remembered it and messed with it in the studio, and Mick wrote some great lyrics, and out came the song.
Money.
Released in May 1968 as a non-album single only, Jumping Jack Flash went to number one in England and number three in the U.S. in the summer of 1968. The cultural phenomenon of Beatlemania and meteoric growth of rock and roll, plus the politically charged issues of the Vietnam War, civil rights, and assassinations of leaders, made for a highly combustible mix, according to Stone's bass player Bill Wyman in his book Stone Alone.
The year before, the Beatles had stopped touring because it was mad, and the same applied to us. As you read in the book, there were so many riots and people getting injured and danger that we just couldn't continue doing it. It just became so ludicrous to do it because you didn't have security and minders in those days. And when you played gigs, you didn't have masses of people guarding you or making sure that nobody got into fights in the audience and that. So it just became virtually impossible to do live shows in places like ballrooms and small theatres and small concert halls before the big stadiums came in. So we kind of stopped. And then there was all the drug problems that year of 67. First Mick and Keith in March, I think it was, or February. And then Brian, I think Brian twice that year. And they were all given prison sentences, which they got off of eventually, but there was always fears that somebody would end up in jail. So we were trying to make Satanic Majesty's album with a hodgepodge of people, and sometimes there was one there, and another time there was Keith and Mick there, and another time there was Brian and Charlie there, and another time there was Keith, me and Charlie there. You never knew who was going to be in the studio the next day, and that's why that album is so disjointed. And Andrew Oldham was leaving us then as well. He kind of stopped producing us halfway through the session, saying there were no more songs being written. It was a very, very strange time. We were having problems with money with Alan Klein. All kinds of things were going on. Anita had switched from Brian to Keith as a girlfriend, which messed Brian up. It was a very confusing period of time.
Oh,
basic guitar tracks recorded at home on a cheap tape recorder. That's the Rolling Stones with Street Fighting Man from Beggar's Banquet. Guitarist Keith Richards sounded particularly enthusiastic when I spoke to him about revisiting the song for 1995's Stripped release.
So that Street Fighting Man, to play it once again in its original lineup, it was too good to resist. I've been playing that thing electric for like nearly 30 years, and after all, it's all acoustic on the record, you know. So to go back and recheck it and say, yeah, you know, and it gives you a chance. I never thought I'd do Spider and the Fly again, or I'm Free, Wild Horses, you know, to cut them again. And then, well, if you're around this long, maybe you can do this, you know. Like, hey, welcome to the Rolling Stones. You didn't catch them the first time.
The album that preceded Beggar's Banquet, 1967's Her Satanic Majesty's Request, was the Rolling Stones' awkward attempt at trendy psychedelia. It was a critical sales flop. The Stones brought in a new producer in March 1968, according to bass player Bill Wyman.
Once that year had got over, you know, and I think we all realized that we'd just gone too far away from our roots, Jimmy Miller was brought in, which was Mick's idea, which was fantastic. And he really helped us get right back there to our blues and R&B roots. And so when we did Beggar's Banquet, we were much more into our old selves. And the sessions were more organized and they were more punctual, and people did turn up on the same night most times, not all times. And they had songs ready, you know, and then we came out with a lot of great songs on that album.
Mick Jagger joins us with a song from Beggar's Banquet, neither blues-based nor rock and roll, that caught the attention of the father of country rock and Americana music. Here's Mick Jagger with me in the studio.
I've always liked country music, and I've always done it. I mean, it's something you do at home a bit, you know, you sit around the piano and play, and or just sit with the guitar and play, and quite often you can... You know, it's a natural thing to do rather than, I mean, I don't really sing rap music at home, you know, with acoustic guitar. It's like, it's more natural just to be sitting around and you sing country. And I mean, since I was a teenager, a lot of country singers were very popular in England, like Johnny Cash. They had like big hit tunes, George Jones, Jim Reeves, and many others were very popular. You know, we had their records. And though I really liked blues and rhythm and blues, this is my first kind of love, country music was very much around. So it's not like a new thing to me. And, you know, I listen to country music a lot. And now, I've said before, I quite like singers like Dwight Yoakam and so on. I really like him. He was in London quite recently. I went to see him in concert. I love the band. I really love his band. It really swings. And then we hang out a little bit afterwards, and then the week afterwards, and you know, I think that his kind of form of country music I like a lot, and it doesn't have a lot to say about Nashville and that kind of music, but the band is excellent band, which I really appreciate. It doesn't play like cliches, and I think it really stands out.
Oh, help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a baiting. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Oh, help me, please, mama. Pain where there once was a heart.
That's the Rolling Stones with Dear Doctor from Beggar's Banquet. Neither Mick Jagger nor Keith Richards have ever definitively stated whether the song was a tribute to American country and Western music or a send-up. But this much we do know. Dear Doctor caught the attention of a young trust fund baby musician from the U.S. by the name of Graham Parsons, and he was totally sincere about mining the country vein of rock and roll in the same way the Stones were exploiting rock and roll's blues roots. Parsons would seek out the Stones and, in particular, Keith Richards. Next, the evolution of one of the most notorious rock songs ever recorded. I'm Red Beard with Keith Richards, Bill Wyman, and Mick Jagger in the studio for the Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet.
This is Keith Richards of the Stones.
Welcome back. I'm Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones with Red Beard.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Bill Wyman, a Stone alone with Red Beard.
Thank you, gentlemen. It is the 50th anniversary of this album, voted as number 57 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 all-time albums list. Keith Richards once told me that his favorite Stones albums begin with 1968's Beggar's Banquet, right on through Exile on Main Street. According to original Rolling Stones bass player Bill Wyman, it's no coincidence that every one of those classic Stones albums was produced by an American named Jimmy Miller.
It particularly worked with Traffic. That was his major contribution to pop music then. And he'd made some good records, and Spencer Davis Band, Gimme Some Lovin' and all those. And they were big hits, and Spencer Davis Band had toured with us as support before that, a couple of years before. We knew them all very well, and Jimmy did great things with them and with other artists on Ireland. So we thought it would be a good merger, and it was. You know, I think he kind of convinced us we should go step back to our roots a bit more, you know, and out came all those great songs. Parachute Woman and stuff like that.
Example of the primal return to roots approach employed by the Stones on Beggar's Banquet, that's Parachute Woman. An example of how a very basic musical concept can be worked, massaged, and expanded by a creative band in the studio is the song Sympathy for the Devil, according to Bill Wyman.
Well, you can see an example of that, a perfect example, which proved my point, when you see the Jean-Luc Godard film One Plus One, which was later called Sympathy for the Devil, where the whole of the recording of Sympathy for the Devil goes through a sequence of many days, changing from like a very slow Bob Dylan-ish kind of thing into all kinds of rhythms with different instrumentation until it finally gels, and then we've got it. And, but that was a week's work, you know, day after day after day. And night after night, I might add, before that became what it was. So if someone listens to it fresh, they think, wow, what a fantastic song to write. But it wasn't. It was a song that was, you know, it was one of those songs that kind of had the lyrics before it had the music, which is unusual for us.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. The pilot washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it. Was a time for change. Killed the saw and
Recorded in June 1968, the day after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. That's Sympathy for the Devil from the Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet album. Bill Wyman recalls that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards had by then taken over songwriting for the band.
Keith wrote most of all the melodies, the songs, with the odd scrap of word or an idea, and Mick would then sit and write lyrics, because he was very good at that, and I mean he's just continued to get better and better as a lyric writer. And then Mick started to get a little bit more involved in the music when he started to practice guitar a bit and take piano lessons. I think he was doing that in about 67, 68. And they did come up with very good songs for us, I mean, and they always have, and they suited us perfectly. And it didn't give much room for anybody else to be invited to participate in it. You'd try to press your claim that you had a song, you know, but it would kind of get ignored, or you'd play through it roughly once and they'd say, yeah, maybe we'll try that next week, but they never got back to it, you know. Whereas with one of their song ideas, which might have been just a very basic riff and a couple of words, you'd work on it for a week, day after day after day, to get it right. So they had all that grounding, they had that chance to write 100 songs that were rejected before they were recorded, whereas myself, Brian, Charlie didn't write, were not given that opportunity of exploiting an idea like that. And I kind of regretted that in a way. I thought that was a bit unfair, but I just thought it was a bit one-sided, and it could have been of a benefit to the band as a whole if we had been given the same opportunities. But I went ahead and did other things. I did film music, I did 4 solo albums, and I've used that in different ways.
Get a click platform, your feet on the stairs. I know you're no scared, honey. You'll be a beast if you just come upstairs, but it's no hanging matter. It's no capital crime. I can see that you're 15 years old. No, I don't want your
love the chug of that song and the way they mic'd Charlie Watts' drums. The Rolling Stones from Beggar's Banquet with Stray Cat Blues, featuring Nicky Hopkins on piano. I'm Redbeard. Bill Wyman, a Stone Alone, returns in the studio for the 5th anniversary of the Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet.
This is Keith Richards of the Stones.
Welcome back. I'm Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones with Redbeard.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Bill Wyman, a Stone Alone with Redbeard.
Beggar's Banquet, released December 7th, 1968. The album had been held up for several months because the Stones record company refused the band's cover art, which was a graffiti-covered public toilet. Beggar's Banquet came out in December with an off-white cover that resembled a formal invitation. The original band cover was issued for a CD in 1984. In his 1990 book Stone Alone, Bill Wyman pointed out that songwriting for a recording group plays into the fragile dynamic that goes on in each and every one of them.
By pure chance, I got one on to Satanic Majesties when everybody was a bit screwed up. When I turned up at the studio and there was only Charlie and I there, the other guys didn't turn up, and Glyn Johns, the engineer, said, and I've talked about that in the book as well, he said, "Have you got a song, Bill?" And I said, "Yes," and we did the song with the help of some of the small faces who were next door in the other studio, Nicky Hopkins on piano. That's In Another Land on Satanic Majesties. And then I did a couple more demos the next year in 68 when we were doing Beggar's Banquet sessions. I had a few songs which I thought were good, and they actually got to demo stage. In fact, one of them was on Metamorphosis, Alan Klein's recompilation of unreleased tracks called Downtown Susie. And there was another one that never came to light. But it was an effort to get involved, as John Entwistle did with The Who and as George Harrison did with The Beatles. But I never got that far. They didn't let me get that far. And so in the end, I just sort of thought, well, give it up. You know, it's not worth fighting over. It's not worth arguing. And I didn't fight much because it was 3-1. You know, I was on my own. And it turns to resentment and people get bad-tempered with each other. So it's best to forget it when you're working. And that's what I did. That's the reason this band are still together, you see, because you've got two very strong personalities in Mick and Keith. You've got two very laid-back people in Charlie and myself who will go along with whatever, contributing, of course, but will swallow your pride for certain times. And Ronnie Wood's in the middle having a laugh, you know, and keeping you all together. He's a very good catalyst, and that's the way this band works. But I did talk about that in the book as well. You know, I did say if Charlie and myself hadn't been so understanding and sympathetic and in that kind of way, you know, the band may never have existed to today. Because most bands break up for those kind of reasons. If it's not girlfriends, it's egos that break up bands. I want my song on the album. No, you can't have it. All right, I'm leaving and form a new group. That's what happened to most bands.
Let's drink to the hard-working people. Let's drink to the lonely of birth. Raise your glass to the good and the evil. Let's drink to the salt of the earth. Prayer for the common foot soldier. Spare a thought for his back-breaking work. Say a prayer for his wife and his children. Burn the fires and who still till the earth. Searching faceless crowd, a swirling mass of green and black and white. They don't look real to me. In fact, they look so strange. Raise your glass to the hard-working people. The wavering don't look real to me. Or don't they look so
Hardworking People, featuring an opening vocal line by Keith Richards, his first on a Stones recording. That's Salt of the Earth from Beggar's Banquet. It was around the release of Beggar's Banquet that the Rolling Stones started to acquire a bad boy image, which was in marked contrast to their biggest rivals, the Beatles. For instance, when the owner of a gas station wouldn't let the Stones use the restroom, the band members relieved themselves on an outside wall, which brought the Stones scandalous headlines from coast to coast. Again, Bill Wyman.
And I think that's where we started to realize how you could get in the papers without really paying for it. Well, financial, you know, money-wise anyway. And so when we went to New York, when we went to America, we went to Chicago, and Andrew Oldham, who was brilliant at publicity, held a press conference in the middle of Michigan Avenue on a traffic island. And we stood there, and of course, it was right outside the Herald Tribune offices, and we hit all the television, all the radio, and all the press, because the police were trying to move us on. The whole street came to a standstill. We had chairs on the traffic island, and they moved us on at gunpoint. But we got enormous publicity, you see. And we started to really realise how you could get publicity from doing things just a little bit different from the norm. And those kind of things really elevated us into another position. Then we became the bad boys and the undesirables.
However, by mid-1968, Rolling Stone co-founder Brian Jones was struggling with drug addiction, drug arrest, and depression over losing his girlfriend, Anita Pallenberg, to bandmate Keith Richards. Brian Jones played what turned out to be his last gig with the Stones in May of 1968, the same month that Jumpin' Jack Flash from the Recording Sessions was released as a non-album single. I asked original Stones bass player Bill Wyman how critical it was that Jumping Jack Flash was a number one hit ahead of Beggar's Banquet's release 6 months later.
Oh, that was incredibly important. Very important. it was just like a Stone single that we'd had 2-3 years before that, when we had that whole mess of... 5 or 6 singles that all went to number one, like Satisfaction, Get Off My Cloud, Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby, 90s Nervous Breakdown, all that lot. It was kind of reverting back to them, but in a better way, I think. It was more mature. But it was one of those kind of songs, and we hadn't had one for a few years. We didn't have one on Satanic Majesty's album. We were doing albums then. All the bands had started to do album concepts instead of single concept albums, recordings. And it was our first big single for a few years. It was very important. And, of course, it went to number one in practically every country. Then, of course, Honky Tonk Women was the next one, which was even greater.
I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Bill Wyman, Mick Jagger, and Keith Richards. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.